I'm David Meltzer. I'm a University of Chicago economist. And in response to Jim's comment, I'll be speaking to you for the next hour and a half. No, I'll actually be silent, and one good way to do that is to have someone moderate a session. But one of the most important reasons to be quiet is that we really do have such a wonderful session ahead of us. The title, as you can see from your program, is Healthcare Reform and Enduring Dilemmas, How Best to Achieve Equity and Access, Quality Improvement, and Cost Control. And we have a really wonderful panel today, and I will say for me a particularly wonderful panel because of the connection of all these people to the Center for Health Administration Studies in the University of Chicago. Our three panelists are Luana Day, who's the Bain Distinguished Professor Emerita in Public Health and Medicine at the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston. And she is a remarkably distinguished researcher who's done wonderful work on access to care and national studies and healthcare assessment. Ron Anderson, who is the Wasserman Professor Emeritus from the Department of Health Services Research and Sociology at UCLA. And Ron has a near and dear place in my heart because he was the director of CHAS at the time I was here initially as a student. And I remember those days very, 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 very fondly. And Stephen Davidson from Boston University, where he's professor of healthcare management. And he is the author of a recent book on healthcare reform. And I think we're going to hear parts of that today. So I'm looking forward to a wonderful panel. Each speaker will have 20 minutes. I believe Ron's going to go first, and then Lou Anne, and then finally Steve. So let me turn it over.
Thanks, David. You know, following Jim Marrone, I feel kind of like Truman the first time around coming after Roosevelt. What I want to share with you today is contributions of the Center for Health Administration Studies, you know, over the years, and what are some enduring building blocks in health services research. If there was a mission, it was to do quality, relevant health services research at the Center for Health Administration Studies. And then to move on a bit to discuss a model that has been my career, really, and has changed some over time, and to suggest just a few of the implications I see from this work regarding the reduction in healthcare disparities that we're so concerned about. Three parts to what I'd like to discuss with you. The first has to do with the Health Information Foundation, HIF, which is really a pre-CHAS era from 1950 to 1963. The second is early CHAS era from around 1963 to 1974. And Luann, I think, will be discussing in some more detail some of the latter contributions of CHAS. And finally, the development of the behavioral model, and as I say, some implications for reducing healthcare disparities. HIF was a foundation started and funded by the pharmaceutical industry in New York. It began in the late 40s and was started as not exactly a foil, but an alternative independent source of information on the healthcare sector to the AMA, actually. And its board was made up of the leaders of the pharmaceutical sector. And they started out really with a very popularized perspective on providing important health information to the population. The leader was Admiral Blandy, who had been head of the Pacific Fleet in World War II. And they had Mr. Magoo cartoons about brushing your teeth and eating well and so forth. But around 1950, they hired this a young professor from Western Ontario University, who was Odin Anderson, and he was had an interesting background. He had a doctoral degree in sociology, but also a master's degree in library science, and he worked with people at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan before he went to Western Ontario as the first behavioral scientist, as far as we can tell, to ever have a regular faculty appointment in a medical school. HIF hired him, and his perspective was to say, you know, what is really important? What do we want to know about healthcare and the healthcare system? And I believe, probably, there are good historians here who might have alternative views, but actually the concept or and the term healthcare system was formulated by Odin. And that led to much of the work and direction of HIF and later CHAZ and the rest of us, I should say. And the other idea that was part of his early career that was permeated through CHAZ and work of many of us later on was the idea of international comparisons of healthcare systems. And he devoted his life to a considerable extent to comparative studies of the U.S., the U.K., and Sweden. And that was also something that continued. We did the first international comparative study in Sweden and the U.S. using a national probability sample of the whole population. And I must say, one thing that continually strikes me, while it may not be so popular to refer to what's going on in other places in our policy, and Jim isn't the first one who said this. I've proposed the importance of it before, dealing with policy makers, and I've heard again that that's not going to carry a lot of weight. But to look at us and see what we're spending twice as much without access to medical care for a good portion of the population as other countries, and a technology that's as good but maybe applied too often and not always enough to the right population, suggests there are better ways to do it. And we aren't so different from the rest of the world that I don't think we can adopt these systems, and we could change. All this comes out of the HIF pre-CHAZ era. Now, a series of national studies, talking about building blocks. This the first one, funded by the drug industry, comes out of HIF and NORC. Who at that time, they're not at the University of Chicago, they're in Denver. And they developed a national sampling frame. It was the first one outside of the census work. The first sampling frame, the very first national study done with this probability sample was the first HIF NORC study that was done in 1952 and 1953. We had the first consumer data, and the argument, we've got to have data at the individual level. We had data from the Social Security Administration. We had data from the AHA and so forth at an aggregate level, but nothing about what was happening to individuals. That is, since I think Rosemary referred to the CCMC studies done in the survey was done in the early 30s. Not quite a national survey, certainly with not a probability sample. And I just, in passing, remind us that they didn't include the black population in that first study. But it was still a Bible, I should say later on for me, getting ahead of time, because we used that information in the series of studies that was done at NORC and CHAZ to compare what's happening over time. Okay, so this was a study done in 1953, and I want to mention Jack Feldman. He had this wonderful combination of Odin Anderson, health systems, an international perspective, and Jack Feldman, who was just a marvelous methodologist. He was head of research then for NORC, designed this first sampling frame, and worked very closely. He was a co-author on that first report with Odin Anderson, very closely with what was HIF then, to develop and report on those findings. And then a second study, 58, and that portended a series of national studies, which CHAZ was responsible for. It was wonderful for a long period of time. We had the only national data that was used, and many people came to us and used the data. I think this is kind of a building, an important building block, because the National Center for Health Services Research actually took over at a later time the detailed collection of data on expenditures from us, and the National Health Survey from the National Center for Health Statistics took over the basic collection on disability and the basic utilization pattern. So it was a transfer, I think, that reflected an important component of health services research, which became institutionalized. The last thing I want to talk about this very early era was the importance of the record studies. You know, you can get wonderful data from people about their experiences. Sometimes it's not as accurate as we would hope with respect to expenditures and details about insurance coverage and so forth. And so this series of studies took very seriously collecting collaborative data from hospitals and physicians and insurance companies and employers. And we put a lot of effort into comparisons of the data and adjusting the survey data. We talk about how do we improve health surveys by using the record data. And again, I think this was an important approach used in health services research over time. Few details about health services research and how it's promoted and used that came out of the HIF era. There was progress in health services that reported the results of these studies, as well as many other issues concerning health and health care, came out monthly. For many years, it had a mailing list of thousands. Policy makers, researchers, politicians. And there weren't, these bulletins are quite common now, I think. They weren't very common in those days. It was a major source of information. Plus, there was the emphasis on trying to get this information out. You know, it took us a few years sometimes to get the books out. And even with the journal articles, it takes more time. This stuff came out quite regularly and quite soon after it was thought to be important. Then there was the HIF research series, which we published. There and after the move, where these studies were reported in some detail with peer review, but again with an emphasis on getting the results out. So HIF moved to the University of Chicago in 1962. after two of the studies were completed, to an academic base, Michigan and University of Chicago were interested. HIF was looking. They got wonderful support from the drug industry, and as best we can tell, they did not try to influence the results too much. They asked for a special study of the drug expenditures, which they got, which showed that in that period of time, the prices of drugs were going up faster than any other component. So that led some of the potential critics to think, well, maybe this place is on the up and up, even though they are getting their funding from the drug sector. So, but they weren't interested in supporting the foundation indefinitely. So the foundation moved with a corpus of support, which is very important to Chaz and the foundation over time, moved to Chicago, and merged with this graduate program in hospital administration. We've heard about Michael M. Davis, and he started the program, and there's just one other little thing I'd like to add to Rosemary's talk. You know, he was a hospital consultant, and the program at that time ended up in the business school. I'm not sure Michael might have preferred it to be in medicine, but it ended up in the business school because at that time medicine was not so anxious to have it. But he did say hospitals and his consulting work should be run more like businesses. And some of that philosophy transferred. He's talking about efficient and effective resource allocation is what he's talking about. And he thought there were ways that hospitals could do better. And a wonderful series of leaders, after Michael M. Davis, Arthur Bachmeyer was superintendent. In those days, the hospital programs were run by the administrators. We called them superintendents of the hospitals in most cases. Bachmeyer was well-respected and an icon in the healthcare industry, followed by Ray Brown, who similarly was extremely well-known. So that was the merger of the two, and we find them still together. That takes us then to the early Chaz era, and a few points I want to emphasize. We had established an interdisciplinary health services research center, and we really did. It was a wonderful opportunity that brought people from all over campus to Chaz. I mean, we have people here who represent many of these different components that came to Chaz if they had interest in healthcare research and healthcare outcomes and health services utilization. You know, we had Gretchen Fleming from sociology and Little and Champney here, behavioral science, and Meltzer, who was an econ in medicine, and Lee Cornelius from SSA, and Davidson from SSA, and Marone from political science. I mean, he talks about the workshop, which was very important. I'll just move ahead one point on that. We had these workshops every Thursday afternoon. Workshops, a tradition at Chicago. We had our own faculty, our students, people from all the major organizations that are in Chicago, AMA, AHA. It was wonderful. It was a major accomplishment, and lots of people were involved in running it. Gretchen ran it for a while. I remember one of her innovations was, you know, we always served sherry afterwards. Gretchen had the idea maybe we should start with the sherry too. Okay, so and then an academic model of graduate education, which was one of the first programs where we tried to integrate some health services research with the training of the practitioners. We tried to do this, and it was George Bugbee, a consummate gentleman leader in the field who had been executive director of the American Hospital Association, and Joel May, who had been a student under the old plan. Well, the new plan changed from a one-year academic, one-year residency sitting at the feet of the administrators and executives in healthcare to a two-year academic program with a summer internship. And finally, the early Chaz era, we started the Michael M. Davis lecture. We had the best known people in the field, policy makers and so forth, in every year. And Michael M. Davis gave the first lecture, the first Michael M. Davis lecture in that program. And that went on and on. I've shipped a bunch of these materials now in the Michael M. Davis lecture. And the George Bugbee Symposium, which ran two days. And again, we took an issue and brought in the scholars, what they had to say, and the politicians and the policy wonks, and it was a wonderful thing. And we published these every year. And I've shipped a whole bunch, a series now, to the Chaz and folks, and thanks for paying, for getting them shipped. But that's good. Okay. So the early Chaz era, I think we've talked about most of these. Doctoral training programs in health services research and medical sociology. We had these programs, and I think it's critical in the development of health services research to have this interaction with the scholars coming along. They were not just our students, they were our colleagues. And we had a medical sociology training program. We had Aida, Giacello, and Gretchen, and Peter Weil, wherever he is, from sociology. And I must say, we also, with their data set, had other people around, hanging on around with the data and the interest we had. One, Claire Corman here, was actually getting her dissertation out of Michigan State, but she was a key person in the HMO study. Maybe Luann will talk a little bit more about it. Was her dissertation. And actually, Luann, you know, she, before she came there, she had took our data and did her dissertation at Purdue, but we shared and interacted that way as well. Okay. The development of the behavioral model. I got into this. I was hired to do the third national study because they couldn't find a director, and they had a grant, and our professor at Purdue lied about my abilities. I shouldn't have been hired, but I was. And so the model you can take a look at and see the various phases are. I would just say that there are implications from each phase. The whole model is there. Basically, it was an interdisciplinary model where I tried to look at why I saw such great disparities in that third national study, why people differed, and whether or not they got medical care and how much medical care they got, and worked out this model of predisposing, enabling, and need factors with utilization as an outcome. Over time, I've added considerable other components, and that's what's kept it alive, as well as me being alive, I think. It's been used in a number of different instances, and I end You'll hear a lot more about suggestions for health care reform which are related to disparities. And Luann will go into that, and that'll be Steve's fundamental talk. My own thought is that we have so much left to accomplish, and we've talked about the enduring problems, which I've experienced. And I end with kind of a downer, I guess, my last slide. But let me just say that I think in terms of what Luann has to say and what Steve has to say, you'll see that there are new ideas and new models which do give us a chance, I think, to build on Obama's effort to use, you know, health and health care as one of the foundations for building the infrastructure in the U.S. So I don't want to say that just because the phases are finished in the model that we aren't going to make good progress, have good opportunities to make good progress in healthcare and healthcare reform.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity to be here today, and it's particularly gratifying to me to see many familiar faces. Those of us who worked in the vineyards and a lot of people who contributed very manifestly to that corpus of work that we're having an opportunity to reprise today. One of the concepts which Ron and Odin introduced me to when I first came to the Center for Health Administration Studies in the early 1970s, and for somehow it stayed with me, and that was the notion of addressing the enduring questions. Those questions that are the large questions, the questions in a way that don't go away, and that we need to continue to approach with new models and new methods, with some creativity, as in effect the dynamics of the healthcare and the health services enterprise change and evolve. So when I was thinking about today's talk, I wanted to identify what seemed to me were three of the enduring questions that the Center for Health Administration Studies researchers addressed, and I think continue to be a concern as we look at the discussions today. And I'd like to frame my discussion around those questions. First, what is the impact of having or not having access to care? These handouts, by the way, are in your registration folder if you wanted to follow it all. Secondly, how well is the healthcare system working? And then third, certainly something that the School of Social Services Administration has very directly and importantly addressed throughout its imminent 100-year history, to what extent are the needs of the most vulnerable being met? I'd like to frame a look at these in terms of highlighting some of the principal CHAS studies, beginning with the mid-1970s, as Ron mentioned. Then look at some of the particular research and methodological contributions that CHAS has made. Just highlight some of the subsequent research that's been done in the broader field of health services and social services and public health research, and then a bit about how my own work is built upon this work. First question, what is the impact of having or not having access to health care? As Ron mentioned, CHAS assumed a leadership role in some major national surveys, the 53, the 58 study, which concentrated on family expenditures, as did the 63 study, but with 63 study beginning to get then into the behavioral model, which Ron formulated and looking at those determinants of health services utilization. A 1970, a 1976, and a 1982 national survey. I'd like to focus particularly on the first national survey of access to medical care. I was really privileged to get my first honest job after graduate school at the Center for Health Administration Studies as a study director for the 1973 study. That project was commissioned by the then new Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It was formed in 1972 and was interested in really having a focus as its foundation mission on access. And they contracted with the Center for Health Administration Studies to conduct the first national survey around that. Bob Blinden was the Robert Wood Johnson liaison at that point. Out of that study, we developed a framework for the study of access that was grounded in the behavioral model. We tried to identify what we framed as potential and realized access, that is, those factors that are likely to be predictive of the utilization of and satisfaction with services. Looking at characteristics of the delivery system in terms of availability, organization, and financing, we see those themes echoed obviously a lot in today's discussion. And then the predisposing enabling need factors of the population at risk. There was an important concept that Ron and Odin developed, that of looking at equity issues, and particularly equity of healthcare with these large-scale national data sets. And how a look at that was framed, as Ron touched upon, was in effect looking at the utilization of services and what factors were determinant of that utilization. If services were distributed on the basis of need or related demographic factors, such as age and gender, then one might deem it to be a more equitable system. If there were other factors that contributed to the distribution of services that were more grounded in factors like whether one had insurance coverage or the type of coverage, whether or not one had a regular source of care or the type of regular source of care, or income, or where one happened to live with respect to physician availability, if those were the factors that seemed to be principally determinant or continued to be determinant of people's utilization of services, then questions of equity of access to health care services might be raised. There are a couple of empirical indicators that we developed in the context of the national survey that attempted to encapsulate that use relative to need notion and be kind of descriptive benchmarks, if you would, of the use of services relative to need. The symptoms response ratio, which looked at the proportion of people who had seen a physician relative to norms that were established by providers of a given age group with this presenting symptom, should they see a doctor or not. And then the use disability ratio, that attempt to look at rates of utilization relative to days of disability. Some subsequent research was, again, importantly initiated by the Johns Foundation. They continued to support access survey efforts. The National Center for Health Statistics, through its supplement, through its body of surveys, looked at various aspects of the healthcare system, including to continue to monitor important dimensions of access. In 1993, there was an Institute of Medicine panel that was convened. It was looking at the monitoring access to personal health care services. And that panel instituted, I think, another important notion and posed an important question with respect to the access research that had been done, is to what will access make a difference? So this kind of so what question with respect to utilization, and is it going to make a difference? And that panel began to really focus a look at some signal indicators of utilization, like prenatal care, and what's going to be its relationship to outcomes in terms of low birth weight or infant mortality. Looking at then childhood immunization rates and how might that affect the rates of communicable childhood diseases. Looking at screening for cervical and breast cancer and how does that facilitate then women getting in for early stage rather than late stage. So we began to shift our focus then from equity of access to healthcare to equity of access to health. This use of services relative to need must take into account then the effectiveness of healthcare services. And Ron in his work has talked about the notion of effective access, and we'll see also efficient access. When I joined the faculty of the University of Texas School of Public Health in 1986, I had the opportunity to work with some colleagues on a course on health service delivery and performance that examined the equity, efficiency, and effectiveness concepts and began to develop a framework that attempted to integrate a look at what are core and co-equally important, the comment on economists notwithstanding, with respect to evaluating the performance of the healthcare system. I'll be talking a little bit more about that framework, so I won't dwell on it now. We had an opportunity also to develop a textbook that attempted to explore that. The second enduring question that I think the Center for Health Administration and Studies has importantly addressed, how well is the healthcare system working? And I want to echo what Ron said about Odin Anderson and his contributions to understanding, even conceptualizing a system. When I was preparing for this talk, I went back and reviewed some of the earlier CHAZ reports. One of them was Research Series 26, published in 1968 by Odin and his collaborator, Joanna Kravitz. And it was attempting to conduct a case study of what is a health services system, how do you develop some empirical benchmarks, what data are out there, how do you capture it in a static or structural sense, how do you capture the dynamics of it. And that case study was set in the city of Chicago and the surrounding counties. And I was just interested when I read that to see that at that stage we were still exploring what was meant by a healthcare system. CHAZ conducted a number of national evaluations. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, once again, funded a number of major initiatives. The community hospital program was intended to encourage the different states for the hospitals to develop hospital-based group practices that would deal with the issue of some people not having access to care, but also the issue that many people were making use of outpatient departments and emergency rooms for primary care. There were over 50 programs that were funded, and we designed access evaluations, and in partnership with Stephen Chartel, who looked at the organizational side, attempted to look at the impact of these programs. The Municipal Health Services program, infusion of funds once again by the Johnson Foundation into five then municipalities to try to encourage the municipal health services and the public hospital systems to develop clinic arrangements that were community-based or hospital-based to try to improve access and also deal with these issues of people coming to the hospital for primary care, and working with both the mayor's office and with also the Healthcare Financing Administration around some waivers for Medicare services to try to enhance the service package. HMO Development Project, a very interesting study, a little bit ahead of its time, I think, in looking at, in a way, the evolution of HMOs, in this case, very contrasting markets, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Chicago. And it an array of qualitative studies and qualitative interviews and quantitative data that attempt to look at what are the facilitators, what are the barriers to development, and on the part of the employers, insurers, the provider, and the broader community. And so I think it's an enduring, I think, insights into that issue. The National Study of Internal Medicine Manpower that began in 1976 and continued through 1973 to look at the changes and the dynamics in the specialty of internal medicine and the subspecialties that evolved, the special challenges that confronted that. And then, as Ron mentioned, the cross-national comparative studies of health and dental health systems. CHAZ contributions in this area, I think, were really important when you think about the design of these large-scale, multi-site, national, international program evaluations. In the dental care study, you were dealing with diverse sites such as Japan, Germany, Poland, Latvia, New Zealand, a couple of Indian Health Service sites in the United States, and San Antonio, Texas, and Baltimore, Maryland. Now, you think about the daunting challenges of trying to then, in effect, design standardized study approaches and procedures and protocols that are both culturally and linguistically equivalent across all those sites. In the service of comparing system performance and outcomes across those sites, and often we have to look and have looked across our borders. We've looked to Canada, we've looked to the UK, we've looked to Australia to try to understand then what these other systems are doing. And certainly a lot of subsequent research around this in the early 1990s with healthcare reform. There was a lot of interest in these cross-national comparative studies to assess public opinion regarding the healthcare system. Bob Linden, once again, and his colleagues continue to carry out these cross-national studies, saying, what do people think of the systems? How do they think they might be improved? How does that compare with our own sort of public assessments of performance? As we know, at the state level, often in the absence of federal reform, that the states are maybe innovating a number of changes. So when the states and their Medicaid programs began to introduce managed care, a lot of interest in trying to evaluate those, as well as other state-level interventions. And then the performance of the proliferation of managed care organizations, a variety of ways then of paying for services and delivering services. I'd like to speak a little bit more about the integrative framework, an approach to effectiveness, efficiency, and equity in addressing this fundamental question of how well is the healthcare system working. So as I mentioned, my colleagues and I define what we'd call two levels that may be at issue. One is we'll call the clinical or system performance level, focusing on the services or from a kind of delivery point of view, and then the macro or the big picture in terms of population health outcomes. How are we improving the health of the public? So holding the system accountable, in effect, in both of those domains. How well is it performing within it itself? But how? Let's look more broadly then at population health as an outcome, and how are we doing? So in terms of effectiveness, clinical effectiveness, improving the health of individual patients through medical care services, we certainly see a lot of interest in patient quality, safety, patient outcomes. The population effectiveness, and how do we improve the health of populations and communities through medical and or non-medical services? Those of you who work certainly in the social work sector realize there are a variety of factors that contribute to people's health when you look at housing, when you look at crowded conditions, with the issues of lead paint, that there are many environmental factors that contribute. Production efficiency, focusing on services, how do we combine inputs to produce services at the lowest cost? So what is the mix of MD, non-MD providers? What about economies of scale to produce services most efficiently? And then allocative efficiency, looking more broadly at the mix of perhaps medical or non-medical investments, prevention or treatment-oriented service to ultimately improve the health of the population, this being the ultimate bottom line. Procedurally, how do we maximize fairness in the distribution of health services across groups? That harkens back to what I'd call the equity of health care focus of much of our early access work, focusing on realized access to services and use of services relative to need. And then substantive, the bottom line here in terms of equity, minimizing disparities in health across groups. So how are we minimizing those kinds of differences with health inequalities as the bottom line of concern? And finally, the third enduring question, to what extent are the needs of the most vulnerable being met? In mid-1980s, CHAS had an opportunity through Johnson Foundation funding to conduct secondary analysis of the 1982 National Survey of the data from the Community Hospital Program, Municipal Health Services Program, as well as a survey of the poor that was conducted in the state of Arizona, and also a study in New York City. And we developed what's called a health policy vulnerability framework to guide a look at that, particularly focusing, I would say, still in the context of equity of healthcare issues, particularly around the forms of regular source of care or not having one, as well as the forms of insurance or the lack thereof, and who seemed to be at most at risk with respect to utilization issues and equity of access to healthcare issues, and what are the factors that seem to mediate that. So began to see who was most vulnerable, in effect, to, at that time, a lot of the strengths and constraints and cutbacks that were taking place. Another project I had an opportunity to work with, the Ventilator-Assisted Children Program Evaluation Project, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in detail. But we had a couple of CHAS research series that came out talking about that secondary analysis and the health vulnerability framework, as well as the pediatric home care study. The Ventilator-Assisted Children Program Evaluation Project focused on a very vulnerable set of infants who were on ventilators. As you know, many children, infants, when they're born and they're born prematurely, they could have lung involvement. And so these were children that became dependent on ventilators, and they, in effect, then would often be in hospitals for long periods of time. So there was an interest in both from the point of view of the cost, but also from the point of view of quality of life for the children and the desires of the family to have the children home, to see what kind of models can we develop for home care in the communities. And there were three different states that were funded to develop initiatives in this area. And this evaluation examined program implementation, intermediate and ultimate outcomes for the patients and their families. So there were extensive interviews with the families, as well as qualitative and quantitative data gathering programs. I would say for me, it really got me into the community, thinking about community, thinking in a more immediate way about people's lived experiences. I think a lot of the work we did were large-scale national surveys, and so this really did, I think, get us into another, to introduce us to another sort of important level. And certainly, been a lot of concern about the categoric, silo-oriented funding at the federal level. What impact does that have downstream? The burdens that state and localities bear. When you think about, there are real trade-offs when state legislatures are meeting between having to fund the Medicaid program or having to fund public education in state. So how do these trade-offs and investments, particularly with respect to caring for the most vulnerable? Community organizations, we talked about the important role of safety net providers and the research surrounding that, to who can make a difference and how. The families and caregivers, and the significant burdens, the uncompensated sorts of caregiving burden. The notion of vulnerable populations. I said when I came to the School of Public Health, one of the things that interested me was the groups that seemed to be slipping through the cracks of our medical care, public health, and healthcare systems. And I was interested in, are there some cross-cutting issues here? Are there some fundamental issues that when we look at the systems that we can see that they're of concern, or we look at the policies, there's some fundamental kinds of commonalities that might surface as we look at this. So I began to pull together information on groups at risk of poor physical, psychological, social health. I picked certain groups that were, I thought, of dominant concern in each of those areas. Poor physical health, high-risk mothers and infants, chronically ill, persons living with HIV/AIDS. In terms of the psychological, those who are mentally ill and disabled, those who experience substance abuse, those who are suicide or homicide prone. In terms of social health, then issues of abusing families, homeless persons, and immigrant and refugee populations. And so I developed a vulnerability framework, which I won't go into a great deal today, to try to take a look at those common issues and cross-cutting themes. I think the sort of accumulation of my experience in this regard and has led me to what I'd say more of an interest in what I call the community, the contextual, and environmental issues. I think that moving into this issue of vulnerable populations and grounding a look from a public health perspective, particularly of how communities frame our very life course, that is moving somewhat more into some of these areas. So the participatory action research, certainly many of you, SSA, conducted this, where we try to promote community participation and power and very much involved in that process. A lot more work is being done in the social determinants there, on fundamental determinants of health, looking at the role of social factors like social status, age, gender, and race, not just tired demographics we use for control, but looking how they shape opportunity structures with respect to residential segregation or political power. It's rather poignant when you read in 1932-33, African Americans were not even included in the sample because they thought you could not get appropriate information. So we've come a long way, but we have miles to go, obviously. In terms of social capital, the quantity and quality of social ties that can be so influential in mitigating then vulnerability. The issue of human capital, the investments in early childhood education, formal schooling, and vocational education that can help enhance human productive potential. Population health policy, integrating medical care, public health, and social and economic policy. Recognize that we all have to be in the same room looking at some of these issues because medical care and public health are manifestly affected by what local governments are deciding about zoning or development policies. And then the population health system, how we build a community-oriented continuum of care with prevention, treatment, and long-term care services, with that prevention going deep into some of these primary prevention concerns that medical care, public health, but I think also the work done in other sectors, education, even employers, employer health, that these fundamental kinds of concerns. And then this book I did kind of try to frame a look at the vulnerability framework, and then collaborating with some colleagues at the School of Public Health, looking at these broader realms of development, economic development, community development, human development, sustainable development as they ultimately contribute to the population's health, and recognize we have to step into these arenas locally, nationally, and internationally in a way to ultimately improve the health of the public. So the enduring questions remain. I think the important legacy that Odin and Ron and the other CHAZ researchers have importantly taught us is that formulating new frameworks or lenses for defining and viewing these questions or these problems, in effect, that these questions sort of summon to our attention, thereby offering the promise, perhaps, of new and innovative solutions to those enduring issues. Secondly, I think that this legacy has taught us the importance of designing and developing and strengthening new research approaches that can be adopted and applied in broader fields of health services, social services, and public health research. And finally, continuing to hold our research accountable to how we, in effect, are improving and strengthening the design of policies and programs to address these enduring service and system and human issues. So in conclusion, I want to applaud the School of Social Service Administration, the Graduate Program in Health Administration Policy, and the Center for Health Administration Studies for their foundational legacy and their sustained commitment to these challenging questions. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity today to be a part of a symposium that acknowledges and honors this substantial legacy and this enduring commitment. So thank you.